Support for The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Candidates for president beat a well-worn path through the Granite State. Democrats in the legislature and Republican Governor Chris Sununu do battle over numerous pieces of legislation. And PFAS contamination became one of several environmental concerns to capture the attention of the public and lawmakers. These and other stories made headlines this year. And today on the program, we're going to look back at the biggest stories of 2019. What stories were most important to you this year? Send us your thoughts by email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Call 1-800-892-6477 or post your thoughts on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. You could also watch a live video of this broadcast at NHPR Exchange on Facebook. And here to talk about the year's top stories are NHPR News Director Dan Barrick and NHPR Senior Political Reporter Josh Rogers. Welcome to both of you.
Good morning.
Thank you, Peter.
So let's start with a little bit more of the immediate news, which is last night's debate between seven Democratic candidates. Dan, let's get your thoughts on this first, because, you know, one of a string of debates. What was your takeaway from it?
Well, it was the first debate in a while in which we've only had a number of candidates, seven candidates, where each candidate could get a fairly decent amount of speaking time. One thing that was just watching the debate that struck me is there's been a lot of talk about the relatively unsettled nature of this field, with no single candidate really showing the ability to break away from the pack or show any kind of sustained momentum. A lot of candidates kind of trading places at the top of the field, and that, I think that came across last night as well. No one candidate really clearly dominated the discussion. But I think in the way the candidates were talking and the nature of some of their disagreements showed that. It's also quite unsettled right now. What are the actual terms upon which this race will be decided? So we had several interchanges with candidates over policy matters, Medicare for all, various other approaches to health care, college tuition, free college tuition, some real clear policy differences there. So there's policy. There's questions about kind of like the rules of the game by which the candidates are going to campaign. We had a long exchange between Senator Warren and Mayor Buttigieg over fundraising tactics and transparency. So that's a clear point of disagreement between the candidates. And then there are these really unsettled questions about sort of identity and representation and gender and race that are under you know, this historically diverse field of Democratic candidates. Yet there was only one non-white candidate on the stage, and that also came up. So it's still really unclear what is the main issue that voters will use or that candidates will use to try and differentiate themselves. Policy, identity, what Mayor Buttigieg called these purity tests around fundraising tactics, and that was sort of a through line last night for me at least.
If you talk to voters, I mean, they're and this is borne out in polls. You know, you talk to Democrats, and they say that their real concern is they want to pick someone who can beat Donald Trump. And to Dan's point, there are lots of ways to get to that decision, but it's sort of it's sort of like I know it when I see it kind of thing has not emerged yet either on the campaign trail or in these debates, which is why. It's going to be interesting the next, however many days it is to February 11th in New Hampshire, what happens out of Iowa. And, it remains the case that, there are plausible scenarios in which a number of candidates could win the early voting states. And a bunch of these candidates have the means to potentially, campaign on for some time. And while, historically, people are always like, oh, we're going to end up in a brokered convention. This year we've got a chance where there are going to be a number of candidates who could plausibly last a while, and absent some sort of galvanizing around one candidate, like that could be our future.
Mm-hmm. I want to spend some time talking about the year-long perspective. The debate from last night will be dissected on other programs on NHPR today. But, Dan, I wanted to ask you because, you know, the 2020 primary is in some ways a familiar story. We cover the candidates, their policy positions, but we also write stories about the primary itself. And one way we did that this year was through the Stranglehold podcast, which you, Dan, have been editing and looking at closely. Broader view, Dan, what has Stranglehold shown us about the primary that wasn't previously either known or well known?
So the podcast has really been a new approach for us in covering the primary, and we've tried to use it to complement our, as you said, our more traditional candidate based coverage. But really, what we sought to do there was cover the primary itself as an institution, as this legacy that persists every 4 years, regardless of who the candidates are, regardless of which party is holding a competitive primary, regardless of the political environment, and really look at all the elements underneath that shape. that shaped the mythology and sort of the history of the primary, that really examined the machinery, that the ways in which candidates campaign and interact with voters and promote themselves.
In which we're kind of taught implicitly to see the primary on the political landscape in our state and as participants in it.
So we did that through telling stories that are in some cases based around characters, individuals like Secretary of State Bill Garner, who have been key to that over the decades, by picking apart kind of scenes that are tropes throughout the primary, whether it's examining, the role that house parties play in not only shaping the interaction between voters and candidates, but also propagating this myth of New Hampshire or this history, this story of New Hampshire as a place where genuine interactions help shape presidential candidates. And it's been a way for us to really also kind of gut check our own coverage and see, are we falling into assumptions around the value of the primary and not really looking at asking questions about why are things the way they are? Why is this institution exist in this fashion? Who benefits from it? And who would suffer? Who would suffer to lose something if things were otherwise?
Well, listeners, if you're interested in learning more about this, go to strangleholdpodcast.com.
We are
very interested in this. Also, the week of December 30th, Monday through Thursday during the exchange, you can listen to episodes of Stranglehold on the air. So appointment listening there if you're not into the whole podcasting thing. I want to move on to more state-level politics. 2019 was a year defined in some ways by partisan fighting. Governor Sununu started his second term with Democrats in the majority in the House and Senate. So let's talk a little bit about some of the big disagreements. Josh, fight over the state budget was a big one, resulted in a veto from the governor in June. What was the governor concerned about at that point?
Well, I mean, he was concerned. He had been pretty clear that he did not want newer increased taxes in the budget. He had concerns about sustainability of spending levels. And, I will say that a lot of people were predicting we would end up with a budget veto, basically as soon as the election shook out the way it did. I mean, it's interesting. It's been pretty common in New Hampshire to have Democratic governors with a Republican legislature. I'm not sure we've ever had a Republican governor with Democrats in control of the state house, not simply the House and Senate, but also the Executive Council. And so it was kind of an interesting moment when the governor remembers his inaugural address. He said, as one might expect, voters here sent us with a message that we're here to cooperate. But, there was pretty scant collaboration all session long on issues. And, when there's a partisan shift in the legislature, there's certain areas where there's going to be friction, things regarding election law. Democrats sought to roll back Republican bills. Those fights are now taking place in court. The governor made pretty clear he was going to veto those. He did. There were gun control bills backed by Democrats. And, the governor made pretty clear that he was comfortable with gun laws as they exist in New Hampshire. You recall the first bill he signed after taking office was getting rid of the permit for concealed carry. An area where there might have been expected collaboration given how present it was on the campaign trail last election was paid family leave. That was seen as maybe an area where there could be compromise, but that really broke down over conflicting views about how to do it and whether, you know, you could do it in a mandatory way as Democrats wanted, and, you know, how you would raise the means to pay for that. Democrats wanted, essentially a payroll tax.
That essentially broke down by the end into pretty traditional partisan war of words with the governor by the end labeling it an income tax, the Democratic plan for paid family leave.
Let's hear a little bit from Governor Sununu on he tweeted a video explaining his decision to veto the state budget. Here's some sound from that video.
As governor, sometimes you have to make tough decisions. I just vetoed the legislature's proposed budget because with today's $260 million surplus, it doesn't make any sense to raise taxes. And this budget creates nearly a $100 million deficit for the next legislature. That's just not responsible management. In New Hampshire, our citizens have always demanded that our budget maintains the New Hampshire advantage. Until we get there, state government will remain open, services will be delivered, and we'll continue working together to make sure we get the job done.
And a few months into negotiations over the budget, Senator Lou D'Alessandro expressed concern about political rancor.
It's harder to work on things here because ideology has taken such a permanent hold on the process. You got the ultra left, you got the ultra right. How do you get to the middle? And it's campaign 24/7. But we've got to get away from that.
Dan, what are your thoughts on or Josh, maybe, what are your thoughts on Lou D'Alessandro's comments?
Well, I think it's true. I mean, you know, when I first started covering the State House, you know, it was pretty much a given that there was going to be some tweaks to taxes and fees to raise more revenue, that, you know, New Hampshire has historically run a structural deficit, which means that, you know, the money we have is potentially like outstripped by, you know, the government's spending absent changes. And so, you know, there's always sort of tinkering around the edge and finding ways to raise revenue. And, you know, certainly, you know, we are in a good economy. So you could make the case that in this moment, you know, perhaps that need was less acute. But, you know, it has pretty much become, you know, a doctrine of the GOP that we're not going to increase taxes. And, you know, Democrats say that they got elected running on things like spending more on schools, which was a key issue in this budget, and that, you know, both sides in this atmosphere could plausibly say, you know, I'm just doing what I ran on. The governor ran on, you know, the idea that he's some kind of, you know, the embodiment of, you know, the so-called New Hampshire advantage, and was going to hold the line on taxes. And, you know, he was going to stick to his guns. And Democrats would say, you know, we ran on a specific policy agenda that included, you know, things like raising the minimum wage, which is another bill that the governor vetoed, which is sending more resources to public schools, which, you know, ended up happening, but using one-time money that's going to have to be dealt with down the line. And so, you know, there was, you know, real philosophical differences. But to Senator D'Alessandro's point, it is true that the impulse to compromise, you know, at the State House, as it is in Washington, you know, is pretty low these days. And, you know, one thing that, people of the State House, you know, it's a very typical thing. They're like, oh, in New Hampshire, you know, we do things differently than in Washington. We actually work together and can get along. And, you know, this year, both at the in the legislature and, you know, around the executive council table, we saw that, you know, things really at times, you know, became purely partisan.
And we'll talk a little bit about that. Yeah, go ahead, Dan.
The resolution of the budget veto, I think, illustrates that, where, as you know, the governor vetoed the budget in June. They passed a 90-day temporary spending plan, and then essentially did not sit down again together till the end of that. The notion that there was, where one might expect, okay, there's a conflict between the two parties over the budget, that they will actually hash out a deal, it was essentially just kind of patched together, you know, some back of the budget spending cuts, undefined, some sunsets on the governor's tax cuts that he wanted to keep in there. But I mean, there were weeks and weeks where there was clearly no conversation happening between Democratic leadership and the governor's office.
Like, part of that may be that, like, we are fortunately in a time where the local economy is fairly strong. So, you know, it was not a circumstance where, you know, jobs were in the offing or, you know, I mean, certainly some people were affected by services during the continuing resolution, which kept spending steady. But, you know, it was not, in the scheme of things, an incredibly dire situation.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of the partisanship that you mentioned earlier, I want to bring one of the stories into focus now. That is that This year, Governor Sununu nominated New Hampshire Attorney General Gordon McDonald for the Chief Justice position on the state Supreme Court. And the executive council tasked with approving such nominations said no. Josh, what's your perspective on what happened there?
Well, I think it's worth bearing in mind that this was Governor Sununu's third appointment to the high court. He had formerly put in Patrick Donovan and, Anna Marconi Hance. And, you know, Democrats had concerns that Gordon McDonald had, a partisan political background. He had worked in partisan politics some time ago. I mean, they certainly, intellectually, I don't think anyone would doubt his qualifications. And, some Democrats would say that they had high hopes for him as a potential administrator. One thing that Governor Sununu declined to do is really consult with the council about this beforehand.
Is it customary for the governor to do that?
Well, he would say it is absolutely not. I would say it pretty much is. And he sat on the council. Ray Burton, who was on the council for a million years, said a million times the first thing a governor needs to do is to learn to count to three. So, you need to get the votes. It is a political body and it's a political process. I will say that, rejecting a Supreme Court nominee, I'm not sure it certainly hasn't happened lately. One issue is that he was going to make him Chief Justice straight out of the box. No background on the no judicial record was a point that Democrats had. I mean, Democrats also, they control the council. They can do what they want. And it's also true that the governor would say that, Gordon McDonald was victimized by the council. Okay, go ahead if you want to.
We definitely want to play some tape from Governor Sununu about how he feels about this.
We have changed the paradigm. We have changed our system going forward, where politics is clearly, to the own words of the councillors here, going to be a litmus test. It is going to be on the table for consideration going forward now, apparently.
So very much not happy about this.
He was angry the day that happened, but he stayed angry. I mean, interestingly enough, that was back in August. He has not made any move to appoint somebody in the wake of Attorney General McDonald's rejection. And so right now, the state's highest court is down a justice. And, you could argue that the Constitution says, the court needs five and the governor's falling down in his duty to make an effort to appoint. I mean, he's essentially said that he believes that the council needs to apologize for what they did. And, interestingly, the governor had indications that McDonald did not have the support when he nominated him. And, he certainly had the option to pull the nomination. And, he says McDonald was ill-treated by the process. Maybe he was, but the governor still put him up when he knew he didn't have the votes. And McDonald went along with that.
This really did seem to mark a turning point in the governor's relationship with the council. And I think just broader political. I mean, outrage in politics can sometimes be a theatrical thing. But to Josh's point, the governor's reaction to this seemed genuine in terms of his belief that the council had been unfair in their handling of this. And I think also it's also useful to remember the governor, in addition to, as Josh said, perhaps not consulting with the council in a way that other governors might have to try and feather the nest for this nomination. The nomination was sort of introduced in a way that I think akin to a sort of a political campaign, press releases with sort of, blurbs from supporters, some Democrats, some Republicans, a very conscious effort to kind of make the nomination seem inevitable. And as Josh said, Gordon McDonald is highly respected within the legal community. And it's unclear whether in a different political environment, with a slightly different tactical approach, somebody of his legal acumen and background could have
been appointed. Different political moment nationally as well, because a lot of Democrats are saying, given the way judicial nominees are treated in Washington, it's time for us to exercise our prerogatives. And, Gordon McDonald, he worked for Gordon Humphrey for years, U.S. Senator, very conservative. He represented the Catholic Church in a moment when abortion is a big national issue. Certainly abortion rights groups were very concerned with McDonald. He's certainly well thought of in the legal community. Governor Sununu thought that was going to be enough. It's really unclear where we go from here because the governor has a judicial selection commission, and you know, if that's still going to be the avenue through which nominees are put forward, you know, there's a timetable for how those things operate in terms of soliciting applications. Like, they haven't not noticed an application, an opening. And so, you know, you've got even a couple month lag. So, you know, for the foreseeable future, it seems, we're going to be one justice down on the state's highest court.
Also, for the foreseeable future, we'll be focusing on election year politics. And, of course, there are two prominent Democrats who are trying to challenge the governor for his job, Executive Counselor Andrew Valinsky and State Senator Dan Feltes. Dan Barrett, can you give us a sense of what we might expect from how they might be doing their jobs as they are also campaigning?
Well, I think they'll be using a lot of the the rhetoric and the real concrete disagreements that they're having with the governor in public as part of their campaign. So as you noted, Andy Valinsky is on the executive council. He was perhaps the loudest critic of Gordon McDonald nomination. There's been several issues in which he's taken the lead.
Just this week, he
called for the resignation of the education commissioner.
Obviously a non-starter with Governor Sununu, but I mean, he says that this, you know, Commissioner Frank Edelblue's role in soliciting $46 million in potential aid to state charter schools without public input would have, you know, the legislature has so far put the brakes on that, but would have obligated the state to millions of dollars of spending down the line, therefore hurting traditional public schools.
If you look on the other side of the building, Senate Majority Dan Feltes, the other declared Democratic candidate for governor, has often been the face of policy, Democratic policy disputes with the governor on issues like paid family leave and the budget. So I think both of these candidates, they'll be essentially, you know, fighting against each other for the Democratic primary nomination. But the policy issues of the last year will definitely bleed into 2020 and define the campaign trail in the race for governor for sure.
This year kind of almost felt like an election year with that dynamic going on, at least, you know, in a week or so, it will actually be an election year.
Well, we've appreciated your coverage, Josh, on this. NHPR's senior political reporter, Josh Rogers, thank you very much for joining us part of the program.
Peter,
we really appreciate it. We're taking a look back at the top stories of 2019, and still to come, NHPR's Annie Ropeek will join us for a look back at the top energy and environment stories of the year. PFAS, biomass, Northern Pass, more after a break. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. And right now we're taking a look back at the big stories of 2019. And for this part of the program, we're turning our attention to stories about energy and the environment. NHPR's Annie Ropeek has been covering these stories for NHPR, and she's here now. Hey, Annie.
Howdy.
So let's start by talking about PFAS, in particular the state filing a lawsuit against makers of PFAS. PFAS chemicals have turned up in drinking water supplies in various locations throughout the state. Give us a rundown of this lawsuit. When was it filed?
So it was filed in late May, and this lawsuit targets the big chemical companies that basically invented PFAS, which are 3M and DuPont, and then DuPont's spinoff Chemours, as well as a group of companies that made firefighting foam, military-grade firefighting foam, which is thought to be the source of a lot of PFAS contamination in the country, especially at military sites. And so New Hampshire is alleging that these companies knew or had cause to know that these chemicals would get into natural resources and stay there, be hard to clean up, potentially cause health problems. And they're essentially seeking damages that could, in theory, someday, you know, pay for treatment or cleanup, similarly to the MTBE settlement we saw with Exxon a few years ago.
Mm-hmm. And how significant is this lawsuit?
Well, it's one of many, like dozens like it all over the country from towns,
other states suing the same companies,
towns, states, cities, individual people, all kinds of lawsuits related to PFAS contamination. New Hampshire says that its lawsuit was unique in the sense that it's the only one seeking damages for statewide contamination. So it doesn't single out any specific location that was contaminated, even though we could point to specific ones like Pease Trade Port or the Merrimack area around the Saint-Gobain factory. But New Hampshire doesn't get down to that level of detail. They just say, you know, this stuff has been found all over the state, all 10 counties, in all kinds of places, and you companies are responsible for that. So since New Hampshire filed this suit, this has been lumped in with all those other suits. They're in what's called a multi-district litigation kind of docket that's being heard in district court in South Carolina. So these are federal cases, and basically it's that they're all so similar and are going to require some complicated discovery and, you know, review of science and lots of similar evidence that the federal court system has decided to kind of hear them all together. And so that's where the New Hampshire case is now.
Okay. So it's going to take a while before this actually reaches any kind of resolution.
Oh, yes. And that was one of the points that came up when this case was first filed, is that, you know, even if this does someday net us, you know, potentially millions and millions of dollars, as it has in certain other PFAS settlements in other states, it's going to be a long time before that happens. And so the issue of how to pay for PFAS cleanup and treatment in the short term is really an ongoing problem.
What have the companies being sued said about this?
Well, they maintain, first and foremost, that they never manufactured PFAS in New Hampshire, which is true, and that's really not, you know, what the state is complaining about.
But they were here, and they were in use with these companies.
That
the chemicals were used here.
Right. And because they're in so many different kinds of products, especially these firefighting foams. I mean, there's really two lawsuits that New Hampshire initially filed. One was about the chemical companies, and one was about firefighting foam specifically. And because that is thought to have contaminated some specific places, and then other places that are contaminated, the chemicals came from other kinds of products. So they chunk them out that way. And so all of these companies, you know, maintain that they never intentionally misled anyone. A lot of them will question the sort of growing scientific consensus around potential health effects and environmental problems that these chemicals can cause. And you know, these are not the first lawsuits these companies have faced over these chemicals. They're certainly not going to be the last. And, you know, they have inked significant settlements with states like Minnesota in the past. I mean, these are enormous companies, like multi-million-dollar, multi-hundreds of millions of dollars in settlements are not a huge problem for them. And so I think that's sort of what these lawsuits aim for.
Dan Barrick.
Annie, I have a question for you. We've been reporting, and PFAS has been in the news for years. This does seem like the year in which it sort of broke through the public consciousness. And I just wonder, given the lawsuit and some of the policy issues around new limits, where you see this going as a policy issue? Is this one of these things where, you know, through the courts and sufficient regulation, we can get our hands around this? Or are we going to be dealing with longer-term health and infrastructural impacts down the road here?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I mean, I think it may be a little bit of both. I think we are starting to see sort of more of a concerted multi-level effort to get our arms around it. I mean, it has entered the public consciousness more. People have more of a sense of, you know, this is in your older nonstick pans and it's in your older, you know, flame resistant and stain resistant carpeting, things like that, that, you know, you always assumed were made of some kind of chemicals that probably weren't great for you. And now you know more about that. And you're starting to see states not just like New Hampshire, but states all over the country have this conversation, begin to actually put forth regulations. And even the federal government is in the next few years expected to make regulations around these. But, you know, I've heard regulators compare this to playing whack-a-mole. Like, there are so many of these individual chemicals, and then what they get replaced with are relatively similar chemicals, and you have to start the process all over again. And this is just one example of the way the chemical regulation system works in America, which is sort of innocent until proven guilty. And so, you know, it is the beginning of a long-term issue, and a lot of the health effects that are linked to these chemicals do take decades to materialize. And so I do think it's the start of a long-term thing.
Also related to PFAS is that the state attempted to put in place strict limits on PFAS chemicals in water. Can you tell us a little bit about what those limits are? And we can get into the details of where those
yeah,
restrictions are
one.
Now. But yeah, go ahead. Tell us what those are about.
Yeah, so these were really the strictest individual limits of their kind in the country when they were passed in July. So initially, the state had proposed limits on PFAS in public water supplies that were pretty much in line with federal advice for these chemicals. And those kinds of numbers are ones that advocates have said are way too high, according to some science. And so the state reviewed some of that sort of newer science, especially a study that showed how these chemicals can affect infants and carry how babies who are pre-exposed through their mothers can carry these chemicals through their lives and kind of be born with like a higher exposure level to start their lives. And the state really drastically lowered its limits so that these standards are really, really strict and could potentially cost towns and water systems millions of dollars to comply with, which is what led to the immediate lawsuit that was filed after they were released.
It's a lot of money to comply with this. And so there was a hold on this.
Yeah. So 3M, one of the chemical companies, got together with some local groups in New Hampshire, filed a suit over these that said basically you didn't do enough cost-benefit analysis over these. You know, maybe they are represent an unfunded mandate potentially, and that the state just didn't do its due diligence when it tightened these limits significantly. And so the judge agreed that there potentially is more work to be done on cost-benefit analysis, public input on these. And so he's put an injunction on these beginning in just a couple of weeks here and said that the state can't require towns to submit any testing data before that injunction goes into place. So the limits are effectively on hold, although the state does say that about 400 towns at least had already submitted testing data before that order came out. And so that's one of my holiday break projects, is to try to go through all of that. And I think, you know, we will in the new year be able to get a sense of the scope of the problem out there. And it'll be really interesting to see how that data affects the court case going forward, because we will kind of know more about the potential liability if these limits did end up going back into effect.
Annie, you mentioned Saint-Gobain Performance Plastics in Merrimack as being one potential source of PFAS chemicals in drinking water in the surrounding community of Merrimack. What has Saint-Gobain's role in this story been in 2019?
Yeah, it's an interesting part of the story in New Hampshire. I mean, we really have two fronts that this happens on here. We have the sort of military fire foam side of things, like PEAS, kind of more of a federal military issue, a legacy issue. And then we have like the point source industrial polluter kind of version of the story, which is Saint-Gobain in Merrimack. And so this is PFAS from air emissions from several years ago, got into many, many private drinking water wells in the area. Saint-Gobain agreed with the state to clean it up. But, you know, with these new standards in effect and sort of more public consciousness around these things, a lot of folks in Merrimack have been saying that what has been done already is not enough. And so they really want the state to shut the plant down, which the state says it doesn't have legal grounds to do. Saint-Gobain has said that it's going to start to set up some sort of community action group with the town, like you see at some Superfund sites sometimes. We've seen protests outside the plant and sort of continuing back and forth between the town and the plant, and also some continuing work on the state to test for the chemicals around the plant, maybe put in some new air pollution controls. So that story is definitely still ticking along.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about climate change. This year we saw protests and rallies held by folks who are worried about climate change. What about the protests over climate change was significant this year?
I think that like Dan just said about PFAS, I think this was really the year that climate change officially burst into the public consciousness. If it wasn't there already, I think that everyone is aware now that this is an urgent problem, and not only an urgent future problem, but something that is a problem now that is currently happening.
And what caused that? What caused the ascendance in public consciousness?
Yeah, you know, we were talking about this on the exchange yesterday, actually, that I think it was a combination of, I mean, the political moment and sort of the evolution of the science, but also just some really severe attributable events, wildfires in California, hurricanes. I mean, those are the big two. And then, you know, those things played out on national television, like during the presidential campaign debates on climate change. I mean, it was really kind of astonishing to see. And so I think it gave people a sense of immediacy to this that it hadn't had before. And that has really helped people just grasp it as a current concept, not some sort of far off, intangible future abstract thing. And so in New Hampshire, we have really started to see especially youth activists mobilizing around this. Hundreds of people participated in global climate strikes here, especially, again, young people, teenagers, students. And there have been lots of protests around fossil fuel infrastructure, things like that. And New Hampshire has really been part of the New England-wide protest movement around climate change. You know, we see a lot of folks come in from out of state for these protests because we share an energy grid, just for one thing. And so it's really a collective issue in that way.
Dan, did you want to weigh in?
Yeah, just Annie, you mentioned the role that climate change has played in the Democratic primary debate in shaping that. You've done a lot of reporting on how voters here are thinking about that and assessing that. And it'll certainly continue to play out. I'm interested in just seeing how, once we get past that into the general election, not only the presidential race, but the race for governor, we've got a Senate race. Do you have any early sense of, like, what role climate change will play in state-level elections in the year to come as a policy issue?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a big issue. It's one of the places we've seen, for example, the governor and his Democratic opponents in that race really diverge. It's also one of the big sticking points he's had with Democrats in the state legislature. Okay. And so they're really using that as a lever for sure in that race to say the governor doesn't support aggressive enough renewable energy policies. You know, he's had a history of sort of skepticism on climate change, which, you know, he has backed off some in recent years. But I think there's still a question of how sort of tentative can you be on climate policy in 2020 and win elections? And I think we're going to see that, especially when it comes to appealing to youth voters, for whom this is a top issue, the top issue potentially. We'll definitely see that happen at the local level.
That said, the issue we were just talking about, the PFAS, does seem to be one area where environmental topic where the bipartisanship does seem to be fairly a real thing. Is that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, in Congress, for example, all of the bills that, like, our congressional delegation has worked on have had bipartisan sponsorship. This, you know, it knows no political boundaries for sure.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about biomass, Annie, because you reported this year that state lawmakers upheld the governor's veto of a plan to subsidize New Hampshire's small biomass power plants. This didn't work out so well for those who are really interested in this. I mean, why is this significant to New Hampshire's North Country in particular?
Well, I think I can hear all of the biomass proponents out there yelling at me that this is not just a North Country issue.
It is not. No, correct.
But, you know, I mean, that's where a lot of our timber resource is, and some of the biomass plants that were affected by this that basically were relying on this subsidy plan to come through in order to remain economical. And after that veto came through, and then at the same time, a federal regulatory challenge to sort of last year's version of this also landed against the side of the biomass plants. We saw a handful of those plants immediately kind of go into idling mode, lay off workers. We're going to see some conversation next year at the state level, again in the governor's race, about how to help those workers transition. And, you know, really kind of mimics like the natural resource industry transitions we see all over the country, like for miners and fossil fuel workers. And up here, it's these biomass workers whose industry really appears to be in decline. Now, I will say I don't think this issue is dead. I've heard talk that there will be more attempts at subsidies next year, attempts to revive these plants. And so, you know, I think this is one of those perennial topics that is definitely not going away.
Okay, keep an eye on this for 2020 for sure. Also worth mentioning, huge story this year. Northern Pass finally came to an official end. There were a few steps involved in its demise. One of them came at the Site Evaluation Committee in 2018, but it didn't fully die there. Annie, give us a rundown of what happened.
Yeah, the great constant on my beat has finally come to a close. Northern Pass had been rejected at the Site Evaluation Committee early 2018. And then Eversource, the utility that wanted to develop this transmission line, went into appeals mode. That case eventually made its way to the state Supreme Court, which heard oral arguments about whether the SEC, the Site Evaluation Committee, basically followed its own rules in the way it rejected the project. And the Supreme Court voted unanimously this summer that the SEC had followed its own rules and that it was valid that they had rejected the project. And shortly after that, Eversource told its shareholders that it was officially stopping pursuing that project.
So what would Northern Pass's impact have been on the New England grid?
So it would have brought this big influx of hydropower into the grid. It would have helped meet Massachusetts' greenhouse gas reductions goals. And potentially passed costs onto ratepayers or potentially passed savings onto ratepayers, depending on who you ask. And so now we're seeing the successor to this project is Central Maine Power's New England Clean Energy Connect project, which is very similar to Northern Pass, is what sort of Massachusetts pivoted to after Northern Pass died. And that battle continues to play out in a very similar way up in Maine.
Okay. And finally, Annie, as far as some stories we may see continuing into 2020, you reported that Northern New England began an ambitious planning process for offshore wind development in the Gulf of Maine. What about New Hampshire's wind industry? What should we be looking for?
Yeah, this is going to be a big story next year, I think. I mean, this is also the beginning of like a probably 10-year process, but New Hampshire is really excited about offshore wind. The governor's office is all in on it. They see a huge economic development opportunity here and an opportunity to develop renewable energy at a pretty unprecedented scale for this region. The Gulf of Maine is thought to have one of the best wind resources in the country. And so we're working with Maine and Northern Massachusetts and federal regulators on looking at what parts of the Gulf of Maine might be a good spot to do this. And then onshore communities like Portsmouth potentially are going to be looking at, you know, could they stage manufacturing or assembly or host the transmission lines that come ashore to bring this power into the grid. There's a lot of potential here and a lot of debate left to be had still about potentially its impacts to fisheries. And so, yeah, we just kicked this process off this month and, you know, it's the beginning of a long road.
You are going to have a busy year, 2020.
Always.
If you care about these issues at the policy level or how they impact people's lives, Annie Ropeek is really the reporter you got to follow. So I just tell people, as you can see, there is a long list of issues, policy issues that are going to be shaping the state in the year to come. Keep your eye on Annie's. Keep your eye on her Twitter feed if you just kind of want to know what's going on.
Is your exact Twitter handle, Annie?
It's A. Ropeek.
A. Ropeek.
Thanks,
okay.
Dan.
NHPR's Annie Ropeek, thank you very much for being with us this part of the program. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All the stories that we're discussing today are at nhpr.org. All the stories from Annie's reporting as well, so feel free to check those out. Still to come, we're going to continue talking about the big stories of 2019. NHPR Sarah Gibson and Jason Moon will join us to talk about education and health-related stories of the year, Medicaid expansion, charter schools, the definition of an adequate education. More after a break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. I'm Peter Biello, and this is The Exchange on NHPR, and today we are taking a look back at the biggest stories of 2019. We've got NHPR News Director Dan Barrick in the studio with us. Also, for this part of the program, NHPR's Jason Moon and Sarah Gibson. Thanks very much to both of you for joining us.
Good morning. You're welcome.
You're welcome.
So, Sarah, let's start with some education issues. Among many education stories we heard this year, several school districts sued the state over the state's alleged failure to provide enough money for districts to ensure a, quote, adequate education. And that word adequate has been so important
it
to
has.
The story. Give us a rundown of why.
Yeah, so, you know, if people are curious about that, I encourage them to go to our series called Adequate. In fact, so we really took a deep dive into this in part because of the simmering issues in the courts, but also, you know, in the state house and across school, across the state, school districts were saying we're not getting enough funds from the state to pay for an adequate education. And that word comes from state Supreme Court decisions dating back to the 90s that really continued and continue now to shape what lawmakers are charged with, which is finding a way through fair and uniform taxation to fund a, quote, adequate education. And that has been defined in various ways by lawmakers and, in fact, will be defined again probably next year with a new committee looking at what adequate really means, what that entails, and how the state is supposed to fund it.
And where are we in the court process for that lawsuit?
So starting early next year, we're going to actually be able to read responses from both parties. Southwestern New Hampshire has a couple districts who are suing the state right now, and also the state's response. So it's going to be looked at by the state Supreme Court early next year, and we can expect to be following that for months to come.
Dan?
One thing that was interesting about just this issue, as Sarah said, it was a bit of a history lesson in that it shows, regardless of which party controls the legislature or who, the tendency has been that this issue does not get policymakers' attention at the state level until it enters the courtroom. And that became the case this year. But I think, you know, Sarah's reporting, the Adequate series and other pieces did a really good job of showing that despite that, This has gnawed at the budgets of many districts in the state for years. It has, in their words, led to an accumulation of problems in terms of the education they've been able to deliver. And I think we're gonna be hearing more stories like that. But in terms of like bringing it to a statewide level, it history shows in New Hampshire you've got to take it to the courts if you really want to get policymakers' attention on this. And we'll see what that leads to. As Sarah said, it's still working its way through, but we're sort of that's where we're at now for the first time in years.
Yeah, and the cycle is always interesting because the courts can't legislate what adequate looks like, so they go back to the lawmakers and say, hey, it's your job to figure out what this adequate education entails and how to raise money for that and send it back to districts fairly. So it becomes the cycle that we're kind of perpetually in. However, I think there will be slightly different conversations about it, and there's a little bit more momentum, as Dan was saying, behind that this year and next.
Mm-hmm. And what about charter schools? Because, I mean, the state was on the cusp of accepting $46 million to expand charter schools in the state. Lawmakers declined the first installment of that money this week. Where do charter schools fit into this larger picture of education in New Hampshire?
Right. Well, they receive a different kind of adequacy amount of adequacy funding that's per pupil that goes out to districts. So charter schools are public in New Hampshire, but they are not getting the same kind of funding from the state. They, in fact, get more money per pupil, technically through adequacy funding. However, they're not getting the same kind of local taxpayer support, nor the kind of fiscal disparity aid and stabilization aid and all these other kind of add-ons that the state house has decided to send to certain districts, particularly poorer ones. But that question about the charter schools, to me, is indicative of a larger division right now that we're seeing between largely Democratic lawmakers and the DOE, with a bunch of initiatives from the DOE to expand essentially school choice, which could look like charter schools, could look like learning outside of the classroom. But, you know, the charter school debate in the last month has really just been the last of several battles between lawmakers, educators, and the DOE leadership over the future of education in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm. So what will you be looking for as you cover charter schools in 2020?
Well, so we're still unclear whether or not the fiscal committee's vote recently, last week, in fact, is truly the end to this $46 million that was promised to New Hampshire from the feds. So it could be that the vote last week to deny the state the first installment, which is $10 million, that really put the kibosh forever on it. Or it could be that the DOE in New Hampshire is able to go back to the Betsy DeVos-led DOE in D.C. and say, look, we have this problem with lawmakers here being concerned, but can we take some of those funds for some kind of charter school initiative? Because the point of this money and really the agenda of the DOE is to expand charter schools. So it could be, depending on conversations that the New Hampshire DOE has with the feds, that the money gets to be moved around in some way. So we're not totally clear if this is truly the end, but it certainly is not the end of charter school advocates, as well as the Department of Education here in New Hampshire calling for greater charter school expansion and a greater focus on charter schools as an alternative to for students as well as parents in New Hampshire.
All right. So more clarity to come on charter schools and funding for them in 2020. Jason Moon, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the opioid crisis, because that remained a top story in 2019. One of the ways the state has gone about connecting people with recovery services is through the Doorway program. Jason, can you tell us about these statewide hubs that make up the Doorway?
Yes. So this is the kind of the statewide infrastructure for spending the tens of millions of federal dollars that have come into the state to respond to the opioid crisis. In theory, it sets up a regional hub across different parts of the state where people can come and get access to all kinds of different treatment services. You know, in practice, I think it's seen mixed results. I mean, it's still new, we should say. You know, it's only been, a couple of years,
a year, really,
at this point. And, so what services are actually available in different parts of the state can vary pretty widely. And it's also, there's some regional tensions that have come up as a result of the program, you know, particularly in Manchester, where in the early days of the opioid crisis, the city kind of developed their own response to it through the Safe Stations program, where people could go to fire stations and get help at any time.
And a lot of people did.
And a lot of people did and continued to avail themselves of that model. So now there's this kind of parallel model of the hub happening in Manchester at the same time. and city officials don't necessarily feel like they are getting compensated from the state level through the federal level through these big grants for continuing to provide the bulk of services. You know, the data shows that a lot of people are still coming from outside of Manchester into the city to find services. And that's, from their point of view, is not necessarily being accounted for in the hub model as it stands now. So it remains the sort of the state's main strategy for dealing with the opioid crisis. I think it's safe to say there's a lot of kinks still to be worked out as it moves forward. But that's about where we are at the moment.
Yeah. One thing this system has also illuminated is the nature of the crisis itself and who needs help. And what are the issues underlying that? Sarah and I have talked about this. She's done some of your reporting, shown that in some of these hubs, close to half the people showing up are showing up with alcohol, alcohol dependency issues, which is not really the way that we in the state talk about this addiction crisis. But that's raised some questions about, and as the nature of drug use and drug addiction in the state has shifted from opioids to the rise of meth. Sarah did some reporting this week about, trying to redirect the spending or redefine how it can be used. But these hubs have really, I think, given some of the issues Jason raised certainly are on the table, but it has given us a more fine-grained understanding regionally of who is suffering, what their needs are, and hopefully, trying to work out how to best get the resources to address those problems more directly.
And in the interest of disclosure, we'd like to mention that The Doorway is an NHPR underwriter. Also, listeners, our digital team has put together a web piece on the most read and most engaging stories on NHPR.org in 2019. It's a month-to-month list, so you can find out the top stories for each given month. Don't miss it. NHPR.org. It's there for you. Also, Jason, another health-related story I wanted to ask you about, the work requirement lawmakers in New Hampshire crafted for some recipients of Medicaid expansion faced some legal challenges this year. There has been some twists and turns on that. Very quickly, Jason, could you give us a rundown of how that played out in 2019?
Indeed, it has faced some roadblocks. So it's on hold currently, pending a federal ruling. So it was struck down by a federal judge in D.C., The Federal Department of Health and Human Services has indicated they're going to appeal the ruling. That comes with the support of the state of New Hampshire and the Attorney General's office, as directed by the governor. So there's still a legal battle ongoing. We are kind of third in line. There's a couple other states who have been going through a similar court process who have also imposed work requirements for people on expanded Medicaid. And the basic idea is that if to receive expanded Medicaid, they would need to complete 100 hours of work or other qualifying activities each month. And, it's kind of the latest version of the battle, the debate over expanded Medicaid that has been going on, ever since the Affordable Care Act passed. New Hampshire chose to expand it, but it did so under Republican control of the legislature. And, one of the frankly, the only way that could have happened politically at the time was with the inclusion of this work requirement. So we'll see where it leads. But at this point, the work requirement is not in effect, and it probably won't be till sometime next year, spring at the earliest, that we could see that change.
And Jason, since we have you here, we need to ask you about developments in the Bear Brook murder case. You hosted this wildly popular podcast, Bear Brook, about the mystery of bodies found in barrels in Bear Brook State Park and about how genetic genealogy was used to identify the killer. So what didn't we know about this case in the beginning of 2019 that we know now?
We know now the three of the names of the victims. So the Bear Brook case centered around four unidentified victims found in barrels just outside of Bear Brook State Park in Allenstown. For more than 30 years, we didn't know who those people were, even though we knew who the likely murderer was. As a result of some work by a genetic genealogist named Barbara Ray Venter, and completely separately, the work of an amateur investigator by the name of Becky Heath, we've now been able to identify three of the victims, Marlise Honeychurch, Marie Vaughn, and Sarah McWaters. Marlise was the mother of Marie and Sarah. That was obviously a huge development in the case that's gone on for over, about 35 years now. But there's still some loose ends. There's still the identity of the fourth victim, another young girl who was about 2 or 3 years old when she was murdered. So that identity of that victim is still outstanding in the case. Remains open in as far as that goes, and there are other potential victims that we know even less about. So who is the mother of that unidentified victim, of that little girl? She's another potential victim that police are continuing to investigate.
So if there is another development that you learn about, safe to say you'll be reporting on it?
Safe to say.
Okay. And so for folks interested, they should subscribe to Bear Brook Podcast, wherever they get their podcasts. Or is it bearbrookpodcast.org?
That is correct.
Okay, great. Well, thanks very much for that, Jason. Really appreciate the update. Wanted to mention a few things, some notable people that we lost in 2019. Mary Stuart Guile died this year after a fight with cancer. She was known as a lifelong advocate for children and education, and she fought in the legislature to change laws for their benefit. She was 83 years old. Also, William Ed Coyce died in a car accident in July. He was the lead whistleblower who, in 2017, went to the Boston Globe with concerns about substandard care at the Manchester VA. His complaints led to a massive transformation at the state's only VA medical center, and he was posthumously awarded the 2019 Nacky S. Loeb First Amendment Award. He was 62 years old. And Concord lost Tom Fredenberger this year. Tom did not make headlines the way other people did, but he did work tirelessly to help homeless people in New Hampshire, lending his time and his talents both as a lawyer and as a handyman to make the city more habitable for the poor. He was 68 years old. Certainly, New Hampshire lost other people who used their lives to make a difference, and we couldn't possibly mention them all here, but we invite you to leave your own tributes to these people who passed away in 2019. Just go to our Facebook page and leave them there. You can search for NHPR Exchange on Facebook and find the streaming video for this show and leave your comments there. We'd love to hear who you think made a difference in New Hampshire who passed away this year. It'd be great to remember them. Before we wrap up, I want to hear from each of you. What are the big stories that you were looking forward to covering in 2020? We'll start with you, Sarah Gibson.
Oh, well, the question of adequate education and education funding is far from over, despite a pretty substantial increase in state funding to a bunch of school districts this year. So I'll certainly be looking at that.
Jason?
The emergency room boarding crisis continues in New Hampshire. There are people, as we sit here now, who are essentially trapped in emergency rooms because the state lacks enough mental health treatment capacity. There's a lawsuit going on right now that we could see some movement on early next year, so that'll be a big story as well.
And Dan Barrick, what stories will you be watching?
Well, we're obviously going to be keeping our eye on the outcome of the presidential primary in February, but I'm really curious to see what the ripple effects of that will be. A lot of the reporting we've been doing in Stranglehold is trying to understand New Hampshire's impact on the national conversation and how the national conversation is trying to shape New Hampshire. And depending on who the nominee on the Democratic Party is, how will New Hampshire's role be viewed by party officials nationally? And will there be any effort to kind of rethink the model as it's existed for decades now?
NHPR's Dan Barrick, Jason Moon, and Sarah Gibson, thank you all very much for being on the program today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks also to Josh Rogers and Annie Ropeek for joining us earlier. And remember, the conversation about all these stories continues online, on Facebook, and at NHPR.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brinley is our program manager. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.